You're listening to the Electric Sheep Magazine podcast. I'm Alex Fitch, and in this episode, to coincide with screenings of an epic but unfortunately rarely seen documentary series from the 1980s called The Struggles for Poland, which is currently being shown at weekends at the Imperial War Museum, I'm talking to Oscar-nominated actress Susanna York about her career, concentrating on the circumstances of her narration for the series, the various examples of other wartime dramas in her filmography, and her growing interest in political activism from the 1980s to the present day. The Struggles for Poland was a 9-part series that covered the first 80 years of life in Poland during the 20th century, and each episode included interviews with people who experienced events in the country at the time, such as politicians, social commentators, Holocaust survivors, and members of the general population, which is accompanied by rare archive footage. Before you hear my conversation with Susanna about her work on the show and the rest of her career, let's begin with her introduction to the first episode.
Once upon a time, Poland was part of the largest and freest Commonwealth in Europe. Once upon a time, Poland was torn apart and ruled by foreign emperors. Once upon a time, the Germans turned Poland into a land of death. But Poland is not, as it sometimes seems, a doomed country. This is a story of hope against all the odds. The story of Poland reaches to the heart of the 20th century.
It's interesting, as an actress, wars seem to have kind of followed you throughout your career, because I had a quick look at all the films that you've done, and everything from Tunes of Glory in 1960, yes. Oh What a Lovely War, 69, Happy Birthday Wanda, June, 71, Falling in Love Again, which you wrote in 1980. The wars...
And Battle of Britain.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And We'll Meet Again after the war. I mean, when various projects are mooted to you, did you find yourself drawn to wartime subjects more often, or was it just because they were better parts?
No, it was the quality of the subjects. I think I can almost always say it didn't always work out, but it was the quality of the subjects. No, I wasn't a particular being drawn to the war or not to the war, though I think it's such an, alas, major fact of our lives that seeing people under different stresses and strains and the way they live and have lived and the variety is, from an actor's point of view, there's a lot to explore and a lot to discover. Mm. And never having, touch wood, so far been in the position of seeing war, living war, and being at the centre of war around me, as in Afghanistan, as in Palestine and Israel and everywhere else, Rwanda and so on. I mean, never having been in that, the cruelty of that, those situations. It's something you don't know and you want to try and imaginatively inhabit in some way, because you're always, it's people that actors are interested in.
Yeah.
And what goes on inside them and how they behave, and both to each other and alone and so on.
Well, I mean, it was interesting to find out that you were a writer as well. When it came to a project like Falling in Love Again, you must have been a toddler at the end of the Second World War. So was any of that based on talking to your parents about their experiences?
No, I don't think it was really. Perhaps a bit. I knew my mother had been blitzed and been in the Blitz. And I did remember putting a mug of milk out with my older sister on the fire escape to try and get a cream over it. And that was during the war. And I remember rationing, of course, that went on, you know, right through to 1950 and things like that. So some of those kind of minor effects I knew of. And I knew my mother had been badly blitzed. But I think, no, I think it was to do with people, the two people that my character and Elliot Gould's character were based on.
Mm.
So I spent, who were American, and spent a bit of time. That was in that film. War and Peace, I mean, Tolstoy divided it up, didn't he? War and Peace, and unfortunately war came first.
Mm. The Struggles for Poland was made in the mid-80s. I was looking at your CV online, and as far as I can tell, that was the first documentary that you narrated?
I think you're probably right.
Do you remember how they approached you to start off
with? Yes, I do. I had a very good friend called Maurice Hatton, who walked into my dressing room in the 60s, liked your performance, wanted to do this film, no money, and it was while I was performing at night, and so I did this little 3-week film, and we became very good friends, and from then on afterwards, I was his kind of talisman whenever he made a film. Sadly, he died. About 8 years ago, but he told me, I remember always very clearly him saying to me, the important thing is with a documentary that you let the pictures tell the story.
Mm.
Don't colour them. Don't try to persuade your audience what to feel.
Mm.
Let the picture tell the story and they react. That's what documentary film's about. And I just thought that was a really good lesson to learn. I sort of put it away in the back of my head and didn't. And then I noticed in documentaries, the ones I liked were always the ones where they weren't trying to persuade you what to think, the voice and all that. And men were usually rather better at it than women, I have to say, on the whole. Not always, but not always. But anyway, and I thought, yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me because it's the filmmaker's vision. And it's the reception of the audience, that's what matters. And you mustn't get in the way of that, but present it and make that connection.
Mm.
Then what happened was, I think I was asked, and I was again performing, I think. I'd certainly done readings and books and things like that on the radio, and radio plays and various things. And when I was approached to do it, my agent said, I was actually doing another play in the West End, and I've been doing enough for my voice to be recognisable.
Mm.
So when they suggested this came up, I said, but and they said they want you to do a test. And I said, but, you know, I didn't usually, you know, I haven't had to do tests for ages now. They know what my voice is like. They could come to the theatre if they want. They could hear it tonight or tomorrow. You know, do I really have to do... Anyway, he said, no, they want to do a test.
Mm.
And so I said, oh. All right. And then I read the brief. That's where I read the brief, and I thought, well, yes, this sounds very interesting. So I said, yes, sure, I'll do it. And when I came in, they were sitting there, about three of them, three Martin Smith, I suppose, and the director of that one, and somebody, probably, I think Neil Asherson might have been there too. And they said, well, thank you very much for coming in to do a test, Susanna. The thing is, we shouldn't really tell you this, but we've had three well-known actresses who've had a crack at it, and actually we pretty well decided that if it doesn't work with you, that we're going to have a man. But, you know, Martin Smith said, I'd like to have a woman. I want a woman because, you know, it makes the balance much better. So I said, well, what specifically are you looking for that you haven't been able to get? And he said, well, I just like the story to be told simply, clearly, and as far as possible, without emotion, but without, or at least warm and alive, but not. So I thought, Maurice. Anyway, I read, and they said, yes, well, lovely. We'll have you, because it's fine. So I think they were quite pleased not to have a man in that occasion, but that's how it happened.
Because I was dismayed to find out that they replaced you for the American version, and I can't imagine anyone doing it better, you know.
Oh, well, that's nice of you to say so. I must say, my dear Maurice, I just learnt so much in a couple of sentences from him, lots of other things in life too, but that. And I always, every time he ever did a film, I always did one little tiny motif or something, or voiceover or something in his film. So, yeah.
When it came to actually recording the voiceover, what process did you go through? Do you watch the footage beforehand to get a flavour of it, or do you just sit in the booth and it plays while you read?
You watch a little bit, but there isn't time. There isn't the time or the money to sit and to have it sent to you in advance. What's there, and that would entail having somebody else reading it, and then you might get coloured by, and so on. So, and I must say, in a way, it was terribly frustrating, because, of course, there would be big gaps. It was very difficult to get a coherent. I had the scripts, or I had some of the scripts, which is what made me be interested.
Well, I suppose the parts that you aren't narrating are being told by the interviewees and by the historical footage. So in a way, as the narrator, you're not always omniscient.
Not at all. No, of course not. So you're looking in and listening in as eagerly as any of the audience and avidly. And I used to get terribly ratty. And suddenly, there was a big jump, and I wouldn't know what had gone before or in the middle of it. So in a way, it was very frustrating because you couldn't watch or take in everything that was being said by any means, because you were waiting for your little number to come up and then you'd pop in and, you know, you had to make it the right length to fit the picture and so on. So it was much more of a technical exercise in that sense. But, you know, I went on through the series doing it, you know, and I noticed it was interesting listening. You know, I think, you know, by about the second or third, I've got much more. The voice is just the
pronunciation.
Not so much the inflections. It's just easier. They're just more natural. I think probably I was a little nervous at the beginning, and, you know, rather conscious of pronouncing things like temporary instead of temporary. You know, wherever, which is what one's taught at RADA. You can't say secretary, you have to say secretary. You know, the first, I think there was just a few little bits and things like that I thought, But then I just forgot it was me. Completely forgot it was me. And that's when I realised that I must be doing it okay.
I mean, it's interesting that you said you were told by the filmmakers that you should just do it naturally and not colour the reading at all. But listening to the narration that had been written for you, it's not entirely impartial.
No, it's not. It's not. The words are not impartial, but it's not entirely impartial. Of course not. And of course, the pictures are not. The pictures are just
devastating.
Utterly devastating.
Well, I suppose what I was getting at is that quite often with documentaries, you'd expect the narration to actually just be very factual and bland. But it's clear that the filmmakers do have an opinion about what you're watching, and that is conveyed through the narration.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, I've done quite a few other documentaries and things since. Quite a lot, really. And not everyone has an opinion. But I suppose that since I had that in my head and felt that from my own observation, having been told, you know, when Maurice first and then started listening, yes, he's right, he's absolutely right. I don't like being told what to think. I want the pictures and me to arrive at a conclusion. Though, as you say, you know, it's not unpartisan, of course, the story, but at the same time, I think the facts were very carefully checked. Very, very clearly, and I thought it was well written, though written by various people, including Martin Smith, one, and Neil, another, and that there was the same tone went through it, and the same tone of presentation, and that mostly, you know, and of course, when I saw the whole thing, you know, that the interviews, the camera just settled and just let whoever was being interviewed speak. And it was just photographing them, just holding them, and I thought that's just the right style. I'm going to be going to, I hope to, a meeting up of the people who made the film, Martin Smith and others, because they're presenting it at the Imperial War Museum, the Struggles for Poland. So there's a meeting for about a reception of about an hour. So I'll tuck that in just before my rehearsal. And it's sort of through the movement of the abolition of war, I suppose, that we're all going, you know, which is it's just a small civil society, really. But it does seek to educate children particularly And at the War Museum, they're very good. They do have visits, school visits for children, which are linked to the national curriculum. And I think it's a sort of educative. They have exhibitions and talks, and they try to raise the awareness that war is not inevitable. So it's a good thing.
In the 80s, you made a few films in Europe. You made Mio Min Mio in Russia, Bluebeard, which was an Italy-German co-production. And in fact, in the 70s, even The Shout was directed by a Pole, Jerzy Sklamowski. Mm-hmm. So your contact with Europeans, presumably some of that would have conveyed to you what the European situation was like. I mean, Poland, for example, when you narrated the struggles of Poland, it was still under communist rule.
Yes, indeed. And I had been to Russia and I had been to Poland. I went with Lindsay Anderson and John Box. We went and we met with Andre Vida for about 3 or 4 days. So I'd been to Warsaw briefly. And, of course, I mean, I've played in the theatre. I've toured very widely. You know, I played in Romania, I've played in Hungary, I've played in Georgia. I've taken my one-woman show, toured all that vividly, but also in other things, of course, and well, Paris and everywhere else, you know, that you go to. Yes, so I have travelled widely and had travelled already widely, both through film and through theatre experiences. I suppose, you know, of course you pick up. Yes, I mean, certainly going to Ceausescu's Romania and Warsaw and seeing the newly built Warsaw and learning how that had been rebuilt bit by bit. And time in Hungary, I played in, you know, twice, 2 or 3 times in Hungary, in different things in the theatre there and in my show. And you know, yes, of course you talk. Of course you talk to people and absorb some of their experiences.
When The Struggles of Poland was made, what were your politics at the time? Was it something that you were getting into or something that's sort of become a part of your life more recently?
No, I suppose when were the cruise missiles? Were 79, 80, weren't they? And Thatcher, and it was sort of, it was having very small children of my own and going to school, taking them to the little nursery, to the, you know, little nursery place. They were 3 and 4, 2 and 3, and taking them there and watching all these other children playing in the playground and going to collect them from school and bringing them back. And it was just children, I think, and having children of my own and suddenly thinking, they don't deserve not to have a world, to inherit a world. How lucky I've been, how lucky my contemporaries have been. We've obviously been... there've been roundabouts and wars and all kinds of all over the globe, and the most recent, of course, being the Second World War. But all over the globe and through Vietnam and through everything, all the other Korean War and everything else that we heard or knew of and experienced third hand, and so on. So I just felt it was very important to try and keep this. The world such as it is, intact, and of course I feel that very much strongly, you know, on the climate change front very much now, that as much as, you know, to preserve this for future generations. So I think that's what involved me first in... also, I was living in Cambridge with a psychologist called Nicholas Humphrey, whose parents had been in the Committee of the Hundred, and who was already himself, you know, into quite knowledgeable, had done 1 or 2 marches as a child and so on. And, of course, I very quickly became educated through him, and I met Philip Noel Baker, I met E.P. Thompson, Bruce Kent people, you know, a lot of people in that who were involved in the issue. And I came to it relatively late, I suppose, but it was having children that did it for me. I hadn't been politicised really much at all before actually going to live in Cambridge. And so I joined CND and was prevailed upon to make the odd speech in Trafalgar Square and various places. It always terrified me. I was never much very good at them, but I did do them.
And I was reading that there's an Israeli anti-nuclear protester who was arrested in the 1980s and spent 20 years in prison and continues to be arrested. And again, that's someone that you've stood up for.
With Mordecai Vanunu, what happened was I was asked to go to a benefit in the, I think it was about...
He was arrested in 86.
Yes, I think it might have been about 89. Mm. I went to a benefit, but well, was invited to it, and obviously I wanted to find out about it a bit, so I asked about, you know, about Mordecai Vanunu, and then was horrified, of course, by his story, and then met some of the people and said I would like to join the campaign to free him. And we did subsequently go to Israel. I went three times, and, you know, with some of the delegation, you know, a small delegation, I think about eight the first time. Of course, we couldn't see him, but we went to Ashkelon prison, and yeah, I remember yelling his name. I've got a big pair of lungs, and yelling Mordecai, hoping that he was exercising in the prison yard. And I'd started corresponding with him, and we went again. We spoke to, you know, we met with the president, and it was the first time we went was when there'd been any publicity whatsoever in Israel, and it was about three or four years on. And gradually we got a lot of publicity, suddenly, a lot of newspapers. And we went certainly two more times, and I also went with some of the group to when he was released from prison. And yes, it was just briefly, he had told the world about that Israel had the atomic bomb, and had told the Sunday Times, and then had been drugged and smuggled back to Israel from Italy, and was sentenced to 20 years solitary confinement, of which he was made to serve every single day, and has been virtually under house arrest ever since in East Jerusalem, and, you know, can't go near an embassy, and has been rearrested recently. So it is an ongoing thing.
Yeah. And I suppose one of the positive aspects of fame is that people seek you out as someone to listen to, and therefore when you started to have political opinions that you knew reflected perhaps a minority of people who weren't being represented in mainstream politics, you could talk at rallies in Leicester Square, you could talk at meetings by the Movement Against War. I mean,
I did it with great difficulty.
Okay.
And with I used to spend 3-4 weeks pouring over the midnight oil writing a speech of 5 minutes for Trafalgar Square, because I never felt I knew enough. I always knew I didn't know enough. I wasn't good at numbers and statistics and those sort of things. But I knew I cared passionately about the subject, but I was very shy of saying my own lines, my own words, writing them and then saying them, and I've never got over that quite, but I've done it quite a lot, quite often. And I suppose because I was persuaded that people do come or do listen, and I knew I wasn't pretending anything, and that they would know that too, and that perhaps I could make them share some of my feelings and experience. And of course, sometimes you're preaching to the converted anyway, but many, many people come newly to a rally or come newly to or go on a march, or so it's those that you're particularly reaching out to, and you feel a kind of solidarity with the people already who are already there and far ahead of you in their knowledge, and so you just want to put your oar in, really.
I read that you dedicated a performance about Shakespeare at the Kameri Theatre in Tel Aviv to Mordecai. I mean, that must have been quite a charged atmosphere.
It was a very charged atmosphere, and the booze, and I mean, there was an enormous mixture of applause and absolute, what's the opposite, boos and hisses and heckling. It was quite scary. And it was a one-person show, so I was on my own on the stage, feeling very vulnerable physically and thinking, someone's got a pistol. I bet someone's got a pistol. you know. But it was pretty scary, actually. But there you go.
I suppose if you have those opportunities, you know, you have to take the risk sometimes.
I suppose so.
While we're on the subject of the theatre, you're currently appearing in Miracle at the Leicester Square Theatre. I was wondering if you'd like to just talk a little bit about the play.
The play is written by a South African writer, a lovely writer called Reza Deven, and it's her second play she's had done in this country. It was her first play, I think, was Missing. Anyway, it was done at the Lyric Theatre about 3 years ago. And so this has not been done in the theatre before, or anywhere before in Britain. She doesn't travel. She hates... So her agent has told me she's very hard to promote because she hates flying. But in fact, I had a phone call from her this morning, which I missed because I was out trying to walk my dog in between everything else. And she's quite hard to pin down. But she's phoned me a couple of times and sent me a lovely card. And I just love the play. I just thought it had a really... It's about a group of actors, a company of actors, a once famous, well-known company who've fallen on very hard times during the Depression. And it's set in South Africa, but in fact we've taken it out of that setting, so it could be anywhere. And they fetch up poor, starved, absolutely on their uppers, down to five actors now, from a glorious company of 20 who used to play all the theatres and travel first class and all that. And they've fetched up in a church hall crypt where they're to give a performance of Everyman. Mm. And into this starving, famished group comes a mysterious woman who sort of puts a cat among the pigeons in various ways. And it's a kind of mystical play and a mysterious play. And there's a kind of mystery quality, and you wonder who this woman is and why she's here, an apparent benefactor, but is she? And so on. And it really, the miracle, I suppose, is this very flawed group of people sort of come through at the end of a crisis happening and things that happen, and they come through rather better than they went in. Okay. I mean, there's a sort of, you know, they've moved on. There's been a development in each single one of them. As I say, a very flawed group from the start, but they've moved on a bit. And it's a miracle. She writes very simply, but it's, there is a kind of strange, I've read other plays of hers, there's a sort of mystical, mysterious undertone, which I like.
And I suppose it's an ideal play for you in many ways, because A, you're an actress who's been in touring productions, and so it is maybe teeny bit, you know, biographical at times. And also one of your most famous roles, if not indeed your most famous role, was in They Shoot Horses, Don't They?, which was also set during the Depression and is about, you know, the exercise performance.
Echoes of that, yes, that's true. Though I'd rather be remembered for Peter Pan.
Okay.
And quite a lot of people do. But anyway, no, but, you know, yes, though, you know, no, that was, Shoot Horses was a hard film to make. Not a happy film to make, but it was a splendid achievement, I think, on Sidney Pollack's part. No.
Brilliant. Thank you.
All right.
The Struggles for Poland is showing this weekend and next at the Imperial War Museum on Lambeth Road in London. On Saturday the 16th of January, episodes 1 to 4 are showing in the Museum Cinema from 10:30 a.m, with episodes 5 to 8 showing the next day at the same times. On Saturday the 23rd of January in the Museum Cinema, there is a reprise of episodes 3 to 5, which specifically cover the Second World War from 10:30 a.m, with episode 9 showing at 3:30 in the afternoon. If you don't have a chance to make any of the screenings or are listening to this podcast after January 2010, you can arrange a private viewing of the series by contacting the film department of the museum and dropping a line to film@iwm.org.uk. As well as hearing her voice on screen, you can also catch Susanna on stage at the Leicester Square Theatre in Leicester Place, which is next to the Prince Charles Cinema in London, in the aforementioned play Miracles, which is on daily Tuesday to Sunday until the 24th of January. More info at www.leicestersquaretheatre.com. Thanks for listening.